Edge with Chris Graham.
Welcome to the pod. I'm Chris Graham. We're going to talk some pro wrestling here on the podcast today. Wrapping a fun weekend in pro wrestling. If you're a wrestling fan, if you're listening to this, you're probably a pro wrestling fan. It was a great weekend to be a wrestling fan. There's a, I think the weekend of the All Out coming up in a couple more weeks might be another one like this. But I don't know. From top to bottom, when you've got three G1 Climax shows, you've got two WWE shows. I didn't watch the ROH show. It's the only thing I couldn't get a hold of, so to speak, from a top perspective. Didn't even get to watch the debut and I guess the whole dumping of the Glow Season 3. That's wrestling, right? Too. I mean, didn't get into that. But so much going on, and we're gonna cover the highs and lows here on this podcast. And let's start with my favorite of the weekend, my favorite of the last month. 19 shows, the G1 Climax 29, and now we're done. And you know, WWE uses its Royal Rumble in January to set the tone for its WrestleMania season that concludes then in April with WrestleMania. It's one show. It's a good show. I like the Royal Rumble as a concept, but G1 is the lead-in to the big show of the year in New Japan Pro Wrestling in January. Wrestle Kingdom 14 coming up in January, January 4th. And instead of just one night of a 30-man, basically a battle royal, the G1 Climax is 19 nights of singles and tag team action, all leading into the same goal, producing the top contender for the World Championship, the IWGP Championship in New Japan's case. And, you know, it always provides not just the storylines for that. That's what we end up getting. We, you know, the intent of G1 is to give you that top contender, but so much else pops out of it. You know, your world champion competes in this, which is an awesome part of this whole thing. The champion actually has a chance. It hasn't happened since 2000, but the champion, if the champion wins it, wins the G1 Climax, well, then he gets to pick his top contender. And so there's that aspect. And then, of course, you know, over the course of not – it's not a tournament. It's a round-robin tournament. So it's not a single elimination. It's not a bracket kind of thing. Each competitor wrestles 9 matches in the 2-10 team or 10-wrestler pods, the blocks. And so you get 9 matches, and if your champion is going to lose a couple matches, that gives – you know, a fall, so to speak, of, okay, well, in the case of this year's G1, Okada, Kazuchika Okada, the IWGP champion, he lost matches to Sonata and then eventually Kota Ibushi. So potentially, you know, those could be two guys who could compete against Okada this fall. Now, we know that Ibushi ended up winning the G1 Climax 29, so he'll be the contender at Wrestle Kingdom 14. So that means, okay, so Sonata, we'll have a lead-in to a match probably in October or early November between Okada and Sonata. So we got something going there. The U.S. champion, who ironically Jon Moxley cannot wrestle in the U.S. for New Japan because of his contract with AEW, but the IWGP U.S. champion lost his final match of the G1 to Juice Robinson, the guy he beat for the title back in June. And we'll have, I'm sure, a series coming up this fall with those two guys. And that's something else to look forward to. So things like that up and down. And we wanted to go over maybe kind of determining. I listen regularly to Figure Four Online, Wrestling Observer Radio. Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez have been talking for the last couple of weeks. Who would your MVP be if you could declare an MVP of the G1 Climax? And so I decided to take that up myself in a column today on Augusta Free Press and kind of think out loud. Who would be the MVP if it was my vote? If it was, you know, and I get to vote on some of these things, not in wrestling, but I get to vote on, you know, I've voted on a lot of college football, a lot of college basketball awards. So if I'm voting, if there was a Wrestling Writers Association and I was a member, who would I vote for MVP of this year's G1? And I started with, well, okay, of course, Ibushi ends up the big winner. He beat Jay White in a match. the match that actually, well, I guess, was today. This is Monday when we're recording this, and you know, Japan is something like 18 hours ahead of us. And so Ibushi, with the win over White, gets the he gets the briefcase. It's actually, there's a briefcase. He'll have to defend that contract at least once, maybe twice, between now and Wrestle Kingdom. And it has happened. I think it's happened in the distant past. And I might be wrong on that, where the guy who's won that has actually lost his defense. But and I'm thinking now I'm wrong on that, because I remember a conversation between Meltzer and, I believe, Meltzer and Alvarez, where they talked about it's got to happen at some point. So when's it going to happen? But in any event, there will be at least one defense where Ibushi will have to put that on the line. It seems written in stone. If anything can be written in stone, barring injury, Kota Ibushi, Kazuchika Okada, January 4th at the Tokyo Dome, that will be the match, right? So it'd be easy to pick Ibushi as the MVP. He finished with an 8-2 record. He had wins over White, former world champion, Okada, the current world champion, Hiroshi Tanahashi, the longtime ace of New Japan. So, you know, that's an easy one to go with there. And, of course, he also wrestled the entirety of the tournament. Got injured in the first match, injured his ankle terribly in the first match, and it was a question as to whether he'd even be able to continue. And he goes from that to going 8-2 and being able to perform at a high level all the way through. Jay White would be another one who could be an obvious contender. He went 6-4 overall, 6-3 in the B block, and then his loss to Ibushi in the G1 final. But, in the last month, I would have to agree with Meltzer and Alvarez on this. They declared on their podcast today, I didn't give him this exact term, but I'm calling Jay White the best heel on earth. He is such a slimy heel. I mean, you know, he's really good at it. There aren't many people in this day and age that take it so seriously. Too many good heels want to also be loved. They want to sell merch and they want to get the media appearances. And MJF comes to mind as well as guys. But Jay White and MJF may be the two guys who take it seriously. Hey, you know, I'm going to be a heel. I'm not going to do the fan stuff. I'm going to be an asshole basically when I talk with people, and I'm going to be even worse when I'm in the ring. I want you to actually boo me. And Jay White in New Japan, he's got the advantage on MJF just because he's a better worker in the ring right now, and he's someone that is really it's a lost art in the wrestling business what Jay White does to get you to hate him. And you really do hate the guy when you watch him wrestle. John Moxley finished 5-4. He was an early candidate for me as far as being MVP. Started 5-0 in the B block, lost his last four matches. You knew he wasn't going to win his block because he wouldn't be believable as a guy getting that Wrestle Kingdom spot. He's going to wrestle regularly in Japan and in AEW, but you know AEW is going to be his primary. So just, again, not believable as the a guy who would, you know, be in a match in the mix for a world title shot. But I'll say this about maybe this is more, maybe not the MVP as much as just how he improved his own stock. I have to admit that when he debuted in AEW here a few months ago, I think it was the All In pay-per-view, was that what that, or Double or Nothing? I'm sorry, Double or Nothing pay-per-view back in May. I was excited, but then, you know, the idea of Dean Ambrose, because his name is John Moxley now, but he, you know, the idea of Dean Ambrose against Kenny Omega as an actual match coming up at the All Out pay-per-view here coming up in a couple of weeks, couple weekends from Saturday, it didn't carry a lot of cachet with me. Dean Ambrose against Kenny Omega, that's a come down for Kenny Omega. Well, what Moxley did in nine matches, over the course of nine matches in Japan, even more than him winning the title in his first match there, beating Juice Robinson for that U.S. title in his first match there, even more than that, because I'm not sure I'm sold on Robinson as a performer quite yet, but over the course of matches with the Jay Whites and the Ishiis and yes, Juice Robinsons of the world in that B block, Moxley looked pretty good. He's now someone that I look forward to seeing him in AEW. This guy, not Dean Ambrose. I'm looking forward to seeing John Moxley from New Japan working in AEW. So he really elevated his own status there. Shingo Takagi's one who really grew on me through this tournament. Again, not MVP level, but and he went just 4-5. But, you know, considering how New Japan tends to treat its junior heavyweights when matched with heavyweights, full-fledged heavyweights, 4-5 is pretty good. I think he actually, I don't have the number in front of me, but I think he actually outperformed Will Ospreay, the man who beat him for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship back in June after the Super Juniors tournament. I think Ospreay was 3-6 in this. But Takagi, man, I tell you what. Now, one, he's, you know, in the U.S., we think of junior heavyweighter. It's called cruiser. The class is called cruiserweight here in the States because junior just sounds bad, according to Vince McMahon. So we can't call anybody junior. But we tend to top that out at 205. That's what WWE, the show is called 205 Live, whereas Japan tops out their weight. Basically, the demarcation line is 100 kilograms, which is 220 pounds. Takagi would not be a cruiserweight in the U.S. He is right at that limit. He's between 215 and 220. But again, the way the booking is usually done there is the guys who are considered junior heavyweights tend not to, you know, be booked to compete well on a general basis with the heavies. And Takagi, boy, he had some great matches. His matches with Naito. And I recommend people listening to this, if you're a WWE fan or a lapsed wrestling fan and you just are curious as to what I'm even talking about here, the New Japan World app. Now, it's not available on all systems. I have a Fire Stick. It's not available, though, on my Roku. So I've got a couple of Rokus. I got a Fire Stick. I have to use the Fire Stick to watch it. Only $9 a month, like exactly $999 yen a month. So it's more affordable than WWE Network and got tons more wrestling on it. Good wrestling, not storyline crap, whatever else. And also for cards that are more than a few days old, and this new the G1 Climax is largely already broken up this way, you can actually watch individual matches from a card. You don't have to fast forward through matches. Again, after a few days, not right away. They'll post the whole show right away. It'll be streamed live, and then you can watch it posted after a show. But then within a couple of days, generally speaking, you'll see matches from a card broken up again piece by piece. And you can search. There's a great search function on this site. You can search for matches, both current and, you know, recent past and then distant past. You can watch old Finn Balor, he's Prince Devitt in New Japan, but you can watch old Finn Balor, AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura, and that kind of thing. But I recommend that you – so now I said all that to say get the app one and then you know, not that these are the only matches you would watch, but you would watch Takagi's matches with Tetsuya Naito and Tomohiro Ishii. Must watches. Takagi really grew on me through this tournament. At first, I was not very impressed. I'm very impressed. Even Taichi came across as a star. I watched, I was more interested in the A block because of the competitors there. You had Ibushi, you had Okada, you had Will Ospreay, you had Zack Sabre Jr. They're some of my favorites in New Japan right now. But as far as the chase for who would win that block, pretty quickly narrowed down to Okada Ibushi. The B block started with Moxley with the 5-0 start, seeming like he was going to run away with it, and then things really tightened up towards the end, so I was watching more of the B block. Taichi is, I'm trying to think who he would be equated to in the U.S., but Taichi's a guy who's very talented, but also very mercurial, and apparently not just the storyline, but maybe behind the scenes from what you gather from reading and listening to some sources. But his match with Ishii was incredible this past weekend, and came out with the win in that. I would say that's a match to watch as well. And really anything with Ishii, he's someone else who grew on me. Ishii looks like a truck. He's probably 250 pounds. He's not a overly cut guy. He's big and strong, kind of like a Samoa Joe without the extra blubber. I mean, because Ishii is not someone who, again, doesn't have the cut and muscles, but he is solid. He's not there's some fat around him, if you want to talk about body styles, but he just looks like a guy who would play fullback for somebody, and you would not want him running down through the hole to create an even bigger hole for the running back. That's, you know, if you're the linebacker, or certainly a safety or cornerback, my God. he's a fun one to watch. He so you would think you'd look at him and say, well, he's just gonna, you know, kind of duck his head and run through people. But he can really work. Some of his matches were among the best in this as well. Okada, you know, and I'm overlooking Okada. I mean, it's hard to overlook Okada. He went 7-2. His losses to Sonata and Ibushi, again, I think that sets up a Sonata match in the fall leading into the Ibushi feud. His wins over Tanahashi, Kenta, Will Ospreay, among others. Ugh, some great stuff. So all that said, I'm going to go with the boring choice and go with Ibushi because I'm so looking forward to the build towards Ibushi-Okada. A dream match, if you want to call it. We just saw them competing here again, as we said, just a couple of days ago at the G129. But, you know, now the stakes are what they are. Ibushi finally has his first win. In fact, this tournament, he had a couple of firsts. A first win over Hiroshi Tanahashi, and then his first win over Okada here. And the build towards Wrestle Kingdom 14. That's gonna be a show that's gonna get me out of bed at like 2 a.m. to be able to watch this. The time difference being what it is, because it was hard this weekend. I gotta say, it was hard avoiding looking at social media and anything else, and watching these shows so I could, you know, watch them without knowing what happened. In fact, I'm not even gonna be able to do that. I have not watched yet the Jay White Ibushi match from earlier today. I've read about it. I know about it, and now I'm gonna watch it. It's really hard. I'm still going to enjoy it, but I have to say that the conclusions of both the Ibushi-Okada match, the A-Block final, and then Sunday's Jay White-Tetsuya Naito matches, it's one thing when you can appreciate an ending even if you know what's happening, but the way the New Japan style is, if you don't know the ending, oh my goodness. They go through so many false finishes at the end. You could almost kind of get to a point where matches build the great matches of a G1. The first 5 to 10 minutes are setups. You know, there's some working done of a body part. There's headlocks. There's some things to wear the other guy down. Then maybe the heel takes advantage for 5 minutes or so. Then the babyface makes a comeback. Then somebody hits a finisher-type move. The other guy kicks out, and now we're started the last 10 minutes, the closing sequence of a match. And there are so many. Then the question is, you know, who gets the advantage? What finish do we get? And it's artistry. Nothing like you see in the States. There is logic to this whole thing. It's not high spot. Let's get this over with in 4 minutes, which is what you see so much in WWE. It's a slow, logical build as presented as an athletic competition. And I'm describing this for you. If you're not a New Japan fan, 19 matches of this month. I'm in wrestling heaven. So that's the G1, wrapping the G1 for you here. Now let's talk some WWE weekend highs and lows. And there, you know, so the hard thing to do, and when I listen to Meltzer, Alvarez, and others from Wrestling Observer talk, they say the hard thing to do is to watch WWE after watching G1. And I will agree. The NXT show Saturday night actually had some good stuff. And there were some things last night from SummerSlam. The one thing that I think really stood out, this wouldn't have been a G1 quality match, but I like the surprise ending. To me, surprise ending. I'm not sure, you know, I try to avoid reading the betting lines. Sometimes the betting lines can actually tell you what's going to happen when the smart money comes in late. There are actually people do bet on wrestling. It's hard to believe, but they do. And the smart money that comes in late is often the informed money. It can kind of give you away. So I've lately just been avoiding that because I want to see what's going to happen and be surprised. The Seth Rollins-Brock Lesnar match was a surprise. I expected Lesnar to walk out with a belt. It really, from my read of this, it didn't make any sense for Brock Lesnar to have that chase for the cash-in, then to cash in to win the title back from Rollins that he had lost to Rollins at WrestleMania just back in April, and then that he would go out at SummerSlam 4 months after losing at WrestleMania and just about a month after, you know, sneaking the belt back with the cash-in to then, you know, lose again. And he did and lost cleanly. And so and now we're seeing the word today storyline that Paul Heyman is complaining about Seth Rollins not giving Lesnar a rematch, and apparently that's the end of it. If Rollins is champion or Lesnar gets no rematches, storyline makes sense from that standpoint. I think what we're learning here is Lesnar's done with WWE. That's the only conclusion you can have. He's not going to work in a non-championship level. I can't imagine. He's not gonna, at least for a while, maybe take an extended break and come back in a couple of years as a Bill Goldberg special attraction type. But we kind of see Bill Goldberg now in that special attraction role. It would not surprise me at all if Brock Lesnar is not done at least for some considerable amount of time, which could include the next time he decides he needs $1 million to work one night. But it feels like to me he's done. From a logic standpoint, two clean losses to a much smaller man in 4 months. Right now, if he's not done, they've killed him. So he's done that way. But that was a surprise. I did not foresee that WWE was going to go in that direction. But it kind of stinks. I put this in my news and notes and my thoughts that if you're Roman Reigns, you chase Brock Lesnar for off and on for 4 years, didn't really ever get the clear hand, the upper hand in that rivalry. And you're Roman Reigns. You're a much bigger guy, and you're on the cover of the video game this year. Seth Rollins, much smaller guy, 2 wins in 4 months. That tells you right now how funny things are in WWE, I guess. Other quick hits. The booking on the Kofi Kingston-Randy Orton WWE title match, if you watched the show last night, you know it was screwy. The booking or the execution or both. The booking was for a double countout, which is an unfulfilling finish. The execution, that was about a 3-second double countout. I mean, literally they fell out of the ring and the match was called. I'm having to guess. This is totally a guess. But based on my knowledge, I've worked in the wrestling business. It's been a while, but I've worked and worked as a writer and creative on a pay-per-view show. I have to imagine here that the ref heard something in his headset, in his earpiece, and misinterpreted that he was supposed to end the match after a countout and just thought he was supposed to ring a bell right away. That's the only thing I could think, is that because he called for the bell so quickly when the two competitors fell out of the ring. But in any case, even if it had been an adequate countout, it still would have sucked as far as the ending to a match. Just a dumb idea executed poorly. Going back to the NXT TakeOver, Adam Cole and Johnny Gargano, what a great match that was, 2 out of 3 falls, and the way it was executed. And here's my comparisons, my doppelganger alerts here. Adam Cole's the next HBK. He just looks too much like HBK. And there's a lot of similarities, charisma-wise and everything else. Johnny Gargano is the next Daniel Bryan. I was writing this part of the column, the Adam Cole HBK reference is one I've had in my head for a couple of years now, so that was an easy one. I challenged myself, though. Okay, so if Cole is HBK, who's Gargano? And I had to think for a couple of minutes, and then it was logical. Then it became logical. Gargano is the next Daniel Bryan, and you know, I'm Daniel Bryan fans. You can write me and curse me out for saying this. I think Gargano is a better Daniel Bryan. I mean, certainly the Daniel Bryan we have now, who can't work the balls out style that he used to because of the issues with the head injuries and needing to dial it back a bit to be able to continue to compete and perform. But the Daniel Bryan, the WWE version of Daniel Bryan, and, you know, right now we're not dealing with the WWE version of Johnny Gargano either. We're dealing with the NXT version. He's on the main roster. Things get watered down when you get to the main roster, but the Gargano I see right now reminds me of the indie Daniel Bryan. And, of course, Gargano was also an indie darling himself. So, but HBK and Daniel Bryan, Adam Cole and Johnny Gargano, you know, the main roster folks will screw it up, but love to see these guys working on the main roster against each other. The best women's match of the weekend, I wrote a column about this, the Io Shirai Candice LeRae match, head and shoulders the best match of the weekend. There were 3 title matches on the 2 shows. The NXT title was on the line. Both the Raw and SmackDown titles on the SummerSlam show last night. By far, Io Shirai, Candice LeRae, they were doing stuff that, I mean, I think it was LeRae who did this. I'm just seeing the move in my head, and I'm trying to remember who did it. But Candice LeRae, I'm gonna give her credit for this until I'm proven wrong. But she did a tope suicido, as we like to call it now, the dive through the ropes, onto Shirai, and somehow midstream, I guess when she connected with Shirai, you know, grabbed her around the head and did a tornado DDT all in one motion, a tope suicido into a tornado DDT. I've never seen anybody do that before, and there were several other moves. My wife can attest to this. God love my wife. When we met and fell in love 20 years ago, she had no idea that watching hours and hours of wrestling, working in the business for a few years, was going to be in her future. Her first words to me were, "You like that crap?" But she sat and watched the two shows with me this weekend, and she can attest, she heard me say several times, "I've never seen men do that before." That was how good this match was. The only other women's match of the weekend that I thought was worth anything, and it was several levels below the Io Shirai Candice LeRae match, but still, this was still good. Trish Stratus, Charlotte Flair. Both those matches, coincidentally, were non-title matches. The title matches, I thought all three of them sucked. But the Stratus Flair match I loved because Stratus, she's retired. She said all week leading into SummerSlam, this was her retirement match. She's done. She's still got it. You know, I wouldn't want to tell her, please ring another 6 months run out of this, get some money, and, you know, maybe fund your kids' education with it, whatever you want to do. Because she could. I mean, she could make some serious money. She could make WWE some serious money. That's how good she still is. You know, again, the WWE would kill it by not saving her for just TV appearances and a you know, two or three matches maybe on pay-per-views. They'd have her flying all over the country working 4 or 5 nights a week, and it just kill the whole goose there. But if they would use her right, then she could work for a couple more years and make a lot of money for herself and for WWE. But they would never do that. They would do it wrong. You know, I said this too in the column that I wrote. You know, she had the retirement match that I'm sure Kurt Angle wishes he'd had. But then you look at it, Angle's retirement match was with Baron Corbin, and Trish Stratus's was with Charlotte Flair. So it's not fair to compare in one sense. But man, she had a great retirement match. And I just wish it wasn't a retirement match. That's how good that match was. Natalya. You know, I'm going down the women's matches, her match with Becky Lynch. She's in that match because she's from Canada, even though she's from Calgary, which is the other side of Canada from Toronto. But I guess Canadians just root for Canadians. So, you know, everybody in Canada was booked on this show to be an important role. Trish Stratus is actually a native of Toronto. But Natalya, there's a reason she's not pushed. She's a heart, and that's awesome, but... You know, it was a submission match with Becky Lynch, and you put someone in a submission match that is as stiff as Natalya is. When I say stiff, I'm not talking about like she hits stiff, you know, that kind of thing. I'm talking she's just stiff. She doesn't bend well. She's not flexible. You know, in this day and age, you've got to have range of motion and flexibility, and she just doesn't have it. And you know, then it makes submission holds, and there were a number. Becky Lynch didn't just use the disarmer. She did win with the disarmer, but. You know, early in the match, she actually put her in the sharpshooter. And Natalya is so inflexible that it made that sharpshooter just look like crap. It looked like Becky didn't know what she was doing. Well, then she tried to put a step over crossface. You could tell Natalya just doesn't have that flexibility to allow submission moves to be put on her. And so, yeah, it just didn't come across well at all. The match with Bayley and Ember Moon, the SmackDown Women's Championship match. Ember Moon was, you know, remember back in NXT, she was booked as unbeatable. She looked good. She didn't look good last night. That was just about a squash match with Bayley. And Bayley, if it's possible for someone to be less compelling as a not only just a performer on a main roster show, but a champion on a main roster show as Bayley. She just had no interest in her at all. I like what WWE's doing with the OC, you know, and I'm saying that as a guy who's a big New Japan fan, and in the OC, they're playing off of the Bullet Club, and you know, they've got Gallows and Anderson and Styles back together. They're teasing a return of Balor, the founder of Bullet Club in New Japan when he was Prince Devitt. You know, I hesitate to like anything WWE does in this kind of sense, but I like that they're actually acknowledging that history between those guys. And I like factions. I like, you know, we all, a lot of you listening to this podcast remember, at least some of you do, remember the 80s and 90s when there were Four Horsemen groups, there were D-Generation X groups, Nation of Domination. Thinking back to some of the territory days, the Stud Stable and Varsity Club and things like that. You know, New Day doesn't even present itself as a stable anymore, and I don't know if they ever really did. I think the idea at first was to have them be a stable, but then they wrestled so many tag matches and, you know, Freebird rule kind of tag championship defenses and stuff like that, that you just until and Kofi now is the WWE champion, but you still think of them as a six-man tag team, not as a stable. You know, and I like this idea. I like the idea of the OC being, you know, a tag team and then a singles guy, the top guy. And I'd love it if they would bring Finn Balor in. I don't know if they will, but man, can you imagine if they did? And then you had, you know, it would be like a Four Horsemen type thing. You know, when I don't know who's Flair and who's Tully in this, because Balor was the founder of the Bullet Club, and you know, Styles has had more success certainly in WWE. You know, Balor was going to be the first Universal Champion, was for a day until he blew his shoulder out. So we don't know how history would have been different if he had not blown his shoulder out in that match with Seth Rollins when he won that first Universal title and had to give it right back up. But you got A. Flair, A. Tully, and you've got the Andersons. or you know, some people would say the best version of the Horsemen was, and I don't remember this version as much, but the Flair, Wyndham, and then Arn and Tully version, or there was the Flair, Luger, Arn, Tully version. Whatever case you go there, you know, two top singles guys, and then a top tag team. That would be awesome. I hope they go that route. They're teasing it, and hopefully they don't forget, because WWE can often forget. Missing persons alerts. People who were just getting who have been getting pushes and were missing in action last night. And I'm gonna count Roman Reigns and Daniel Bryan. They didn't wrestle. They played some silly skit basically. That's not wrestling. It's SummerSlam. You're missing two of your big guys for SummerSlam. Shinsuke Nakamura. What the hell? What is going on? What's going on? You're not The Miz. The Revival, the Usos, Kabuki Warriors, Baron Corbin. Baron Corbin not gonna miss, but he was in the main event last month. He didn't even appear on the show. They didn't even talk about him last night. Got to do better than that. So that's the busy weekend in wrestling that we have. So kind of signposting the rest of my week, we're going to talk on Wednesday with Rod Mullins. Had to push him back a couple of days. He was available today. I'm not available tomorrow. I'm going tomorrow. Morgan Wallen is going to perform at the Rockingham County Fair, just up the road from me, about a 45-minute drive. And my wife and I are going to that concert. We're going to go see some country music up at the Rockingham County Fair. Always some good shows up there, so looking forward to that. So no podcast with Rod tomorrow. But Wednesday, we'll do a podcast with Rod. Of course, Friday, Jerry Carter and I will talk sports ad nauseum, ad infinitum. I'm a Latin guy, so took Latin 5 years in high school. And we'll see. The UVA news beat should be picking up soon. We're 2 weeks from today. UVA football, which I cover extensively, heads into its first game week, because the first game is August 31st. So we'll be getting ready for that. But it's still kind of quiet right now. VMI football also. My first VMI football broadcast is September 7th. So we're not too far from that. We're less than a month away from that. So we'll be getting you ready for football season as well. Well, thank you for listening, and thank you for your interest in our podcasting services here at Augusta Free Press. If you have any questions, topics you want me to address on a future podcast, you just want to yell at me about something, that's fine too. Email me at AugustaFreePress2@gmail.com. You can tweet at Augusta Free Press, or excuse me, at AUG Free Press. Couldn't fit all that into the Twitter handle, so AUG, A-U-G Free Press. You can Facebook message me. I don't get on Facebook that much, but we have a Facebook page with over 99,000 likes, followers, whatever they're called. My wife manages that page, so, you know, but she'll make sure I see your message. You could mail me, I guess. You know, find my mailing address. Good for you. Try not to make that available. Don't want to be swatted if that's ever, God forbid. But I'd love to hear from you. So please, if you have things to share, share them. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great, great day.